Here on a test stand not far from San Francisco is a rocket engine of an exciting new type which will make manned interplanetary travel possible. To find out more about solid fuel rocket engines, stay tuned to Science in Action.
One of the most exciting new developments in our efforts to conquer space has been the news that the United States is working on definite plans to send a rocket to Mars within the next 5 years. Now, when this rocket is launched, it will probably be powered by a unique new solid fuel engine developed at the laboratories of United Technology Corporation in Sunnyvale, California. To find out about this, we've invited as our guest on Science in Action the assistant manager of the solid rocket branch, who will tell us about this remarkable engine and its contribution to space flight. It's my pleasure to welcome Mr. Anthony C. Keithley. Tony, come in here, will you please, and have a chair. And let me ask you a little bit about the background of the solid fuel rocket program. Is the solid fuel a new thing, a new concept, or does it go back in years?
Well, actually, Earl, it dates back from the 11th century when the Chinese used solid fuels to repel the Mongolians. In the modern state of the art, however, solid propellant rocketry is relatively new, primarily because the German V2, the first liquid fuel rocket of any magnitude, was used so extensively. It wasn't until just recently, after the development of certain attributes of solid propellant rockets, such as their inherent reliability and simplicity, that they began to take any impetus at all in our space picture.
We do have solid fuel engines now that are functional in some of our rockets and missiles.
Oh, very definitely. They are used in a variety of missions. Possibly the most important, however, and surely the most popular, are the Air Force's Minuteman and Navy's Polaris. Here we see the Navy Polaris taken off from the ground launching test, which succeeds or precedes all of the liquid tests. These tests, of course, will follow any of the strategic purposes, and I should think that by now the Polaris system has proven itself to the point to where it would be considered a strategic vehicle.
Tony, in looking at these sketches, which give us the basic comparison between the liquid engine, which we have indicated here, and the solid fuel engine, which we have over here, this one seems to be very, very complex, whereas this one seems to be relatively simple.
The simplicity of the solid engine is its primary advantage. As we can see, the liquid engine is a chemical plant from the very beginning. We have an oxidizer tank and a fuel tank. These ingredients are pumped into the combustion chamber via a turbine driven by a gas generator. The back pressure is high, and the controls required here are quite extensive. You might say that this is a high-performance machine, very much like a racing car. And like a racing car, if it doesn't operate at its highest performance, it's not much use to us.
Now, when you say this is high performance, do you mean by contrast that this is not high performance?
I wouldn't want to call the solid propellant rocket low performance. The point is it has a different kind of performance. For example, if I might quote Dr. von Braun, we could say that the liquid fuel rocket is comparable to a cigarette lighter, whereas a solid fuel rocket is very much like a match. There are certain attributes here which both the liquid fuel rocket and the cigarette lighter compare. For example, we have an on-off capability simply by turning on and off the valves. And to a certain extent, we have, or to certain design limitations, we have a thrust magnitude capability. On the other hand, with a solid, once we ignite it, we have to live with it. And if we do put it out, then we can't reignite it. As you can see, we have the propellant inside of a case. The exhaust gases are expelled through a nozzle, and these three components make up the system. That's more or less it.
Well, if I were a person involved in a space flight, the reliability you've indicated for the solid fuel rocket would be something I would certainly be interested in.
Oh, well, in this country, as you know, the value of life is all important. However, there's one other consideration we should take into account. Primarily, that is, this is due to the fact that as we fire missiles from Cape Canaveral, almost anybody can go down and wants to take a trouble and see these firings take place. As a result, if we have failures, we have to, and there is a possibility that failures will always exist, then our embarrassing luck is broadcast all over the United States, or the world for that matter. On the other hand, it's interesting to note that the Russians, with their secrecy, could very possibly have even more catastrophic failures, including the loss of life in some of their orbital vehicles, without us being the wiser. And it would be very difficult for us to prove.
Tony, I would be interested in knowing something about the sizes of these vehicles that you're talking about compared, that is, these future ones, as compared with some of the vehicles we know about today.
Well, we want to differentiate first between the orbital vehicles, such as the Russians have just put into space with a man, and those which we want to talk about, specifically the manned flight to Mars or Moon. I think this can best be compared by this shot, where we show a Nova as compared to a Minuteman size-wise. Now, the Nova is about 220 feet tall, and the Minuteman is one-fourth of that height. Compared to this is a Saturn, which represents our next step in our next step using conventional hardware in the area of space exploration. We are going to need an engine to for the Nova, which is several million pounds of thrust, many orders of magnitude more than Polaris. But before we get into that project, I'd like to show you our first conical segmented engine.
This is with a solid fuel.
As a matter of fact, this is a case of an engine that has been fired.
No, from the sizes of these others we've been talking about, it's somewhat interesting to find that this is so small.
This is one of the first tests we ran about a year and a half ago, where we were exploring some of the subscale features of the conical segmented approach. Of particular interest, however, and this ties in with my conical segmented approach, I would like for you to see or to note that this unit is conical shaped and it's segmented.
Well, why this peculiar shape? Why do you have to have this shape? Why couldn't you use a teardrop design or some other design?
As long as we have to stay within a regime that is structurally sound from the standpoint of internal pressurization. But insofar as the conical shape is concerned, I might be able to illustrate this from a picture. If we imagine, excuse me, I'm already drawing conical, a street which is dead end at one hand, and on the side of the street we locate buildings, office buildings, and at come quitting time, then the people pour from these buildings all at the same time. You can imagine then, as they drift in this direction, what happens if we go along here far enough to the density of these people.
You'd have terrific congestion right at this point here.
Right. And this is the importance of the conical solid rocket motor. We can again draw our diagram, but this time I'll draw it conical. And here we will feed in these people. Let's imagine for the moment we're still in our buildings. We'll feed the people into the into the line of traffic. But as their density increases, we will widen out the street, very much like a freeway is widened into additional lanes when you do get into the heavier populated districts. Now, with the solid rocket, as we add these segments to it, or add the gas to the stream, we design the conical shape so that the density of the gas throughout this is maintained constant. This allows us then to add segments as long as we desire in order to achieve the required thrust level. And eventually, after we do achieve that thrust level, we can attach a nozzle on the end, and this is our rocket chamber.
Let's see how that would work by means of this model which you have over here that needs to be assembled.
Well, we could start out from any size particularly and build up our rocket motor to deliver the desired thrust in discrete steps of thrust. We could imagine these each capable of delivering, say, 250,000 pounds of thrust until we get a rocket engine of the desired thrust level.
Suppose now you only wanted to use the top two sections.
Very simple. For smaller vehicles, and the Nova or the Saturn or anything else we might be talking about, we will just take off the two segments, put a nozzle on it, and we have another high-performance rocket motor.
Tony, could you take any one of these sections and ship them individually? It doesn't have to be shipped as a whole element.
That's the advantage of segmentation, naturally. In the design of the segments, we limit ourselves from the standpoint of weight or dimensions so that we are not limited by highway traffic, railroad traffic, or barge traffic, or whatever is available to us for the specific mission in mind.
Well, I understand how these engines are put together for solid fuels, but I'm wondering about the solid fuels themselves. Now, are these related to the things that we've known as gunpowders all of these years, or are they a little bit different?
Some of our propellants are related to gunpowders. However, the ones that we're using United Technology are of a composite base. We use an oxidizing compound, such as ammonium perchlorate, with aluminum to add to the fuel, and we put this into a binder, a rubber-type binder, which gives us the required physical properties. For example, here is a specimen of a dog bone. We take this to measure the elongation. And
This is the result of mixing, then, with the binding agent.
Yes, many people are concerned or do not believe that we mix the propellant like bread. For example, we're showing here the ingredients being mixed in a mixer, and from this, we will take the propellant and cast it into a segmented motor. The segmented motor being located in our oven. The scene shown here, this is the assembly, the fabrication of the oven, which we think is the largest in the world. I might add that this oven now is completed and is ready for operation.
I don't yet understand why this has to be elastic. Why couldn't you make it a little bit more solid than it is?
Being elastic is a desired attribute of solid propellants in that when the propellant is loaded in the chamber and under ignition is pressurized to approximately 700 psi. This pressurization forces the chamber walls, the steel walls, to expand. The propellant then has to expand with it. If it doesn't, the propellant will crack and it will lead to catastrophic failure or an engine blow-up.
On some of our discussions, you used the term grain in describing this, and this is a new term for me.
Grain is a piece of jargon left over from the gunpowder industry. Any single piece of propellant is usually called a grain. If we add more than one piece of propellant to make up the charge for the rocket, then this is called a charge. Many times the words are used synonymously.
We've been handling this for quite a while. Is it dangerous at all?
Only if not handled with respect. In normal use, we will machine these pieces, we will manufacture the pieces under remote control where the operator is protected either by bulletproof glass or he's behind concrete barricades. But if we subject it to extreme shock or vibration or give it a rough treatment, then there might be a chance of explosion or fire.
Can we burn some of it?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. If you would take that piece and take it away from
this. I'll be happy to.
So that the sparks won't shoot on it.
We have a small piece right here, and I might mention that in order to show this, we'll have to put a special glass over the front of the television camera lens. Otherwise, we'd sort of burn a hole in the camera, and that wouldn't be very good.
This propellant in burning burns at a temperature of approximately 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, so that it gets quite hot. Actually, under pressure, as it will be in a rocket motor, it'll burn much faster than that.
You know, it's difficult to appreciate the fact that as this was burning here, that this is undoubtedly the kind of propellant that will be used to put a man in space.
As a matter of fact, Earl, it is probably the propellant that will make space exploration feasible. I'd like to tell you a little about the technical problems involved. Our objective at the present time is to build a booster capable of putting a manned orbit into a trajectory so that we may go either to Mars or Moon. This booster, entitled for the concept we're talking about, a Nova, is illustrated thusly.
In this model that we have here,
This model will generate something like 15 million pounds of thrust.
Well, I'm wondering why you go to all the trouble to build a new kind of an engine when we've been using some of these liquid engines. Couldn't we build the reliability into these liquid engines, increase their size, and do the same job?
That might be possible. It would certainly be very expensive, but most important, it might be very time-consuming. We feel that a solid propellant booster of this magnitude can be built much more expediently and developed much more expediently than a liquid system. Besides that, there's another point that should be considered, namely that of reliability. With a conventional military rocket, 100% reliability isn't required, and nor do we expect it. If the first missile fails, we just fire another one. However, when we're putting a man into space, 100% reliability is a definite must. We either succeed or we fail. There's no middle ground.
Well, then you would say that for manned space flight, that the solids are in every way better than the liquid fuel.
Not necessarily. The Nova vehicle, as we're talking about here, might very well be a solid propellant booster, as shown, and on top of which we will locate the appropriate number of liquid propellant stages. In this particular case, we have two stages or two additional stages to allow us to reach the desired velocity to approach the moon, and then a stage to land at the moon, a stage for return.
You know, I'm a little bit surprised because here you are a solid fuel man, and now you have combined two disciplines, the solid fuel engine here and the liquid fuel engine in this section.
This is a matter of economics. After we boost this out into space, it becomes such a expensive vehicle, we have to put the highest possible performance out there. As a result, this is liquid.
Tony, I'd like to throw a curveball at you. You know, about a year ago, we had a guest from the Livermore Radiation Laboratory at the University of California, a good colleague of yours, Dr. Theodore Merkel. And one thing that he told us about was old Pokey, the nuclear reactor. And he pointed out that a nuclear reactor heating up liquid hydrogen then could drive it out of the nozzle, and this would be a method of propulsion through space. Now, isn't it possible that the nuclear reactor might be a method of doing this easier than what we're talking about here?
I'm sure Ted Merkel went on to explain that to do this would require many breakthroughs in the art of nuclear technology. It's doubtful to me and others that these breakthroughs can be accomplished in time for the Nova. I might add one other point. If they are, then it's highly conceivable that the booster will be a chemical booster, namely a solid booster with nuclear stages on top to replace the liquid stages.
Well, to find out how Nova might actually work in operation, let me take this model over to the Earth, which we have right here, space here, and the moon out here, and we'll find out what would happen then as we drive this missile towards the moon in this fashion. Would you tell us about that?
I'll try to roll within the scale limitation of the blackboard. First, if this is the Earth, our Nova system will, in its attempt to put a man on the space, will first send a system unmanned to the moon in order to have at the moon waiting for the man a return vehicle. Takeoff will be accomplished in more or less a vertical position, and the booster pointed towards its initial direction. At about 25 miles altitude, the booster will burn out, firing the second stage. The second stage then will carry the vehicle on up to approximately 100 miles altitude, firing the third stage. And the third stage will give the payload a proper velocity increment to allow it to fall towards the moon. This span of time will take approximately 60 hours. As the vehicle approaches the moon, it will rotate itself due to outside jets, and using its fourth stage, make a soft landing on the surface of the moon. Now, if their landing has been successful, they can take off using their same vessel compartment. If it is not, they can shift over to the other compartment, and the final and last stage will be fired in such a manner that we will go through the moon's gravitational pull, come back into the Earth's field, and fall towards the Earth until we enter the Earth's atmosphere, at which time we will release parachutes or some other drag mechanism to slow us down for a soft Earth landing.
Well, we have a surprise waiting for us out in the street, and it's so large we couldn't bring it into the studio. And so, to get an idea of what we're talking about, would you diagram it for us on this model, which I understand in its total length is over 200 feet in length?
As we can see here, there are approximately 11 motors making up this, each motor consisting of 7 segments. I want to call particular attention to this little segment right at the top. This is the motor which, when tested, will represent one of the largest solid propellant rocket motors ever tested, and it is only 1/77th of the total Nova booster.
Now, you will be testing that soon, I know, and we have that out in the street. We couldn't bring it in, so let's go out there and see what this actually looks like. It's a tremendous thing. In fact, we couldn't even get it on this side of Mission Street. We had to take it on the opposite side of Mission Street in order to be sure that we would be able to get it in proper perspective for the cameras. So as we come down here right now, We'll walk to a distant position down here. In fact, I think if we go right over to about this point here, where these two feet marks are right here, we'll be able to see the size of this. Now, you gave me some dimensions earlier, but I don't remember all of them. Would you give them to us again?
This particular vehicle is about 25 feet high, measuring an average of 8 feet in diameter. It will deliver a thrust of approximately 250,000 pounds. It's specifically interesting to note that if you can see right at the bottom, just above the nozzle, there is a shiny surface, which is the aft joint.
Yes.
In the course of our test work, we will take off the nozzle at that joint. We replace it with a segment just like it and test in sequence until we arrive at the full 7-segment unit for the Nova system. This unit, our unit this size in live form, will be tested, we hope, very soon. We'll follow that very shortly with a double segment motor, exactly twice this height, twice thrust, shortly after that.
Yes, now superimposed over that is the diagram showing the total length of this. And that very small section down in the left-hand corner represents what we're looking at here in its actual size as we see it here.
That is right.
Now this, again, to review the dimensions on this, as I remember, you said it was 8 feet across at the top, and that was, 100 feet up in the air, and down at the bottom?
It follows its conical shape. It'll be about 11 feet in diamameter down at the bottom. Uh-huh. And this is 100 feet tall.
100 feet tall, and then on top of this will be the liquid unit, which will be a part of the Nova system in addition.
To a total of approximately 220 feet. Uh-huh. It's interesting to note that the nozzle that we use for one of those vehicles will in itself be just about as big as this object we're looking at now.
Mr. Anthony Keithley, I want to thank you, sir, for coming up from United Technologies to tell us about your work in this field.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you a great deal, sir.
Thank you.
April of each year marks the month when Guide Dogs for the Blind hold programs in many states across this country. Now, on previous Science and Action programs, we have looked at some of the dogs used in the training programs. And over on the far side, you may recognize the Golden Retriever. Next to that, the Blackfellow, the Labrador Retriever. And then next to him, the well-known German Shepherd. Now, there's one kind of dog that we haven't looked at previously, and he's standing over here. And this is the Chesapeake Bay Retriever, a dog that gets its name from the fact that in the early days, it actually carried ropes ashore for the pilot boats in Chesapeake Bay. Now, Bud Maynard has brought this dog over, and I gather, Bud, that this Chesapeake has just started his training program.
That's right. She's just started out, so she's really a green little girl.
Would you show us the sort of things that you do in this first phase of the training?
Yes, we can show you a little bit about her obedience. We won't go into too much of it because we'd have to force them too much in the beginning.
Yes.
But just for one particular exercise, we can show you. Come. Tulsa, come. Now she'll have to come around behind me and up to my left side and sit. Then she's ready to go through with the rest of her exercises from there.
And then, let's see, Tulsa's been training now about 2 weeks.
About 2 weeks, yes.
I'll ask Don Madden if he will take one of the other dogs here that is further along in his training, the German Shepherd, perhaps.
Yes, we'll take Cheyenne. Cheyenne, come. Following the come exercise, the dog will then go into his down. Cheyenne knows it already. He's doing it through routine. Cheyenne, sit. And, of course, the sit. Stay. One of the things we teach the dogs is the fetching exercise. Shane, that's a boy, fetch it. Good boy, hold
how,
it.
How much training does the dog take before it starts working with its new master?
Well, they go through a series of training tests and so forth for 4 months before they go into school with the blind person. Mm-hmm. And then they go through 4 weeks of rigorous training with their blind master. This is a resident training where the blind person comes and lives right at the school for 4 weeks.
Let me ask you a little bit about the temperament of the dog as it relates to the temperament of its new master. Is this something that you have to determine based individually on the person and on the dog?
Oh, yes, Doctor. We find that in the dog as well as the person, there are many, many different type temperaments and so forth. So we have to match the temperament of the dog, his size, his speed of walk, and so forth, to the blind person.
Bud Maynard, I want to thank you, and Don Madden, thanks also for bringing these dogs over from Guide Dogs for the Blind. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor.
Next week on Science in Action, plastic surgery will be our topic, and our special guest will be Dr. Marr McGregor. Please plan to be with us at that time. Thank you very much.